Thank you for inviting me. I was there for there we are, we're back. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor and privilege. This is my home crowd. I got my start doing speaking about interesting topics in San Francisco. It's 13 years ago now. But I've got to let you know something up front. You cannot trust me. You can trust Daniel because he's trying to sell you his book. I'm halfway through it. I have no comment yet. You can trust Eric because he's trying to sell you his book and being quite successful at it, because I have read his book and it's very good. I'm not selling anything. I'm not getting paid for this performance, although thank you very much for flying me down here. You can tape this talk. You can give it away. You can share it. Creative Commons. I don't know my words. But you can't trust me because you don't know what my motives are. And I'm not even entirely sure if I know what my motives are today. So you've been warned, and it's a full moon right now. And be glad I don't have slides. Because the title of the little talk today is Empire. Part one, Houses of Stone. So I'm 5/6 of the way done with my trip around the world. I did a trip around the world last year, just this time. And again, this year, I'm taking almost exactly the same route and I'm following the sun. And the first leg of the trip was from Sydney to Pisa. And I'd landed in Pisa, and my luggage didn't. And since everything except for the clothes on my back was in my luggage, I was a little bit freaked out. And I was really jet-lagged because it's 24 hours on a plane to Pisa. And it was fairly horrible for a little while, and I'm sort of fighting off a massive panic attack, realizing that if I have a meltdown, I don't even have tranquilizers to fix it. And somewhere in there, I managed to have an epiphany in the Pisa Cathedral. I was worried and afraid that I'd lost it all and I'm about to lose it all. And instead, I pay €2 and I get ushered into the hush and the quiet of the Pisa Cathedral. Now, Pisa Cathedral is old. Take the oldest cathedral you've been in, and it's older than that. It's basically the first cathedral. Its cornerstone was laid 1,000 years ago. All right? Most of the other European cathedrals can't really compare. They're youngsters. And so it doesn't have a clearly defined style, because defined styles in cathedrals hadn't developed yet. It's the first example. Everyone sort of took pieces of this. And it defines its own style, the Pisa Romanesque style. Because it's neither Romanesque nor is it Gothic. Gothic comes later. I know none of this, though, because I'm too cheap to pay €3 to have the headphones that will provide narration which will frame the experience for me. Because, frankly, I want my experience raw. And it's a good thing, too, because I'm walking around and I see the quiet sanctuary. I see a reliquary of Saint's bones. I see a very famous painting of Saint Anne with a lamb. And I see beneath me a harlequin pattern in white granite and gray granite. And I look up and I see the roof, which is gilded and flowered. And I felt something come alive within me. And for the briefest of minutes, the only way I can describe it is I became the human Wikipedia. I could look at the arches in their harlequin colors and understand the stresses and how they were balancing the cathedral so that it didn't fall in on us. I could look at the frescoes and understand volumes about Byzantine art and the construction of the human form. I could look at the saints pictured on the paintings and understand their stories and how that this cathedral was meant to be read by someone in a pre-literate era as a book, as an open story. It was all spelled out for me. It was all there. It was all present. And it didn't feel overwhelming. It didn't feel like my head was going to explode. It felt really wonderful and natural. It felt like it should always be this way. It's as if I knew that layer upon layer upon layer didn't make the experience overpowering, but instead amplified each element of the experience and brought it into focus so that I could feel all these elements as if they were viscerally part of me. I sensed the whole within the parts. Now, of course, this was jet lag and fatigue poisons and the beginnings of a panic attack. Okay. Missing luggage. It showed up later. Things got calm. But it doesn't matter, because I'll take that moment. I liked that moment of epiphany. It showed me a way that we can be in a space, in a culture, and be participating in that culture. Now, a few days later, right, stressed, calmed down a little bit, and relaxed, I'd got on the train at the crack of dawn with some friends and went to Rome, and I've never been to Rome before. And of course, when you go to Rome for the first time, what do? We go to St. Peter's, of course, right? It's Rome. So I find myself among the pilgrim throngs in St. Peter's Plaza, the Piazza, and like the sweeping hand of a clock, you get swept in around the edge of the Piazza into St. Peter's, and then we're in, and there's only one word I can use to describe St. Peter's: loud. So where Pisa spoke in very sort of hushed tones about sacred things, St. Peter's is thundering grandeur from every possible inch. It's a building that's designed by Michelangelo. It's the biggest church in the world. I looked up and there's an arch, and it doesn't go all the way to the ceiling, it's just a wall arch, and I realized that I could take my 11-story apartment building in Sydney and slip it underneath. That's it. That's how big it is inside. And then you can look around and you see there at the altar is the baldacchini. The baldacchini is the greatest piece of bronze work from the Baroque era. It is so big that they ripped the ceiling off the Pantheon down the street, which had had its brass ceiling for 1,500 years, to melt it down to make the sinuous curves of the baldacchini, which is arguably one of the most beautiful pieces of Baroque art in the world. And look over there. Those are the bones of St. Peter. I mean, that's it. There it is, it all starts there, and they're in the bones, and you can see them over the very Baroque railing, and everyone's running around quietly, taking lots of pictures of the reliquary of St. Peter's bones. And then over in the corner, sort of tucked away almost, sleeping, is the body of John the 23rd, the Pope who created Vatican II, the reason the Catholics have Mass in English now, when I was raised a Catholic. And interestingly, he's dressed in a cute little red coat, with a little white trim and a little red cap, and he looks like Santa Claus. Now finally, at the end of this parade of wonders, after you do a long Jeschel wind around the interior, and I was very careful to do all the churches Jeschel, you come to the greatest of the sculptures of the Renaissance. And that's not David's, although everyone thinks it is. It's Michelangelo's Pietà. All right, and it's tucked away in the corner because in 1972, someone took a hammer to it and knocked off the Virgin Mary's nose. They fixed it, but it's away. And you're all familiar with this. It's a very, it's one of the iconic images of Mary holding the crucified dead Christ in her arms. Pietà, pity. The image, it's famous, it's ageless, it's timeless, and it's an archetype, and it transcends that momentary revelation in the Catholic faith, because what it tells us and has told us for 50,000 years is that the male is temporary and mortal, and the female is eternal and endures. And that goes back to Isis and Osiris. It goes back to Inanna and to Uzi. It goes back before writing. It goes back before names. It goes back to red ochre on cave walls with hunters that have been gored and oxen that have been spared. And all of this then forward again. Living woman cradles dead man. And you have the photograph of Kent State. You have Yoko Ono cradling John Lennon. And that's no hidden code that helps you find the way to Mary's bones. It's older, and it's wiser, and it's truer. And finally, just as we're walking out, the midday Roman sun shines through a glass cupola like a shaft, and it hits the ground in front of us. And we're drawn to it. We stand in it, looking up, illuminated. And I come to understand something as that light is shining down on me. The empire never died. From the moment that that fascist bastard, Julius Caesar, crossed the Rubicon in 52 AD, there has been an absolute continuity in the Roman Empire. The names have changed and the technique has changed, but the song remains the same. It's the asserting of one man's primacy over another. It's that one could, by force or threat of force, instill obedience, but force carries within it the seeds of its own destruction, because to use force is to breed those capable of resisting it. So all empires fall, as the Roman Empire did repeatedly in the 3rd century. But power is crafty, and power evolves. So power emasculated itself. It exchanged the male for the female, the temporal for the spiritual. And so the other meaning of the Pietà is the eternal, holy, Catholic, and apostolic church bearing the bones of the Roman Empire to its tomb. Power died so power could live and continue undiluted to the present day, 2 millennia later. And that's when I realized, with the light coming down, that we are in the Imperial Palace, by any other name, set next to the foundations and the remains of Nero's Aurelian Palace, the Golden House. And we're in the heart. We can feel that we're in the heart of this immense, absolute, overwhelming power. And then we emerge back to the piazza, and our souls are gasping for breath. We're quite literally gobsmacked. We're dazed, we're confused, we're disoriented. There's echoes of Imperium resounding within us. So 2 days later, I'm back in Pisa. And once again, I decide, let me go have a look in that cathedral. It was really wonderful and nice and special. And I walk inside, and it's the most curious thing. I'm deaf to the sacred stillness I could hear just 4 days ago. It's been drowned out by the gilded trumpets. Grandeur is potent, and sometimes we forget that, although I will come back to it. Part 2, Houses of Wood. And so to America. Now, I no longer live in my homeland, so I'm subject to the sentimentality of the emigrant. It's not that I grow misty-eyed and think, oh, I should move back here. It's rather that when I come to America, I can be the one thing that I never could when I lived in America, a tourist. So some months ago, when I was planning this entire trip, I decided that there was something that I needed to do that I'd always wanted to do, and that I was going to drive the entire west coast of the United States from San Diego, where my family lives, to Seattle. And I'd seen all of the cities because, you know, you live a jet lifestyle and you land and you land and you land and you see the intervening territory from the airplane, but you don't actually get a sense of the country. I'd never really been north of Mendocino. And so I rented a nice little SUV and gassed it up repeatedly and headed north. And first I went to Humboldt, of course, that land of lore, which is a magical name to potheads everywhere. And I found out what it meant to live in a place where quite nearly everyone is stoned nearly all of the time. Because there's a lot of dreadlocks, there's a lot of natural fibers, and there's a lot of slightly slack expressions on people's faces. It's happy enough in its way, for those who can bear it or bong it or roll it. But to me, it felt a bit like a childhood that I'd outgrown, as if I came across a playground where I was a little too big to swing in the swings. They no longer fit my body. Now, in 15 hours in Arcata, I ate a meal, I watched a trippy DVD, I smoked some hash, and I had a full body massage. It's the kingdom of the body. It's the realm of the senses. But I was shooting beyond that. It wasn't enough to hold me in its grip. So instead, I headed out into another orbit. I left Humboldt behind. and the coastal fog burned away just as I was leaving Humboldt behind, as if a fog was clearing. And I could see the doors to the earthly paradise behind me clanging shut, that paradise of soy milk and hybrids and Birkenstocks. But now came the main event, the reason I was driving, the Oregon coast. And it was there, in miles and miles of perfect Northern Pacific beaches with etched rocks and steep cliffs and titanic redwood driftwood tossed ashore like tinker toys. And everywhere the pulse of the sea and the unceasing wind. It was too much, too much, too much. I ate the entire Oregon coast in a single day because I was so greedy and so hungry for it. And when I arrived at my hotel after driving for 8 hours straight, I wasn't exhausted, I was strangely exhilarated and immediately rushed out to the beach because it was 9 p.m., sunset, Land's End in Lincoln City, to watch the most beautiful sunset I have ever witnessed. And as the sun started to hit the sea, the clouds so many miles distant trisected the face of the sun, which you could stare at, and then it became fat, and then squat, and then a point, and then gone. It was nice. And at that point, I was done. I'd had enough of trees and beaches and boulders, and so I decided, okay, it's time for a mad dash to Seattle. Well, that's what my plans were. It wasn't what the universe had in store, because 24 hours later, I was headed out to the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State to finish what I'd started. Now, the Olympic Peninsula is the home to the whole rainforest. It is the only temperate rainforest in the Northern Hemisphere. And so at midday on Friday, amid a light mist and dappled sun, I stood in front of a Sitka spruce that was 100 meters high, and Douglas firs as big around and straight and erect as I'd ever seen, and everywhere you looked was a riot of green, green upon green upon green, and green things falling down and still growing where they fell because there was enough. Everything was absolutely alive. Everything was impossible to ignore. The giant trees pointing to themselves, all the other life simply enjoying all of the water and all of the energy. And we found a grove, it was a little off the path. And of course, it was a full moon and me being a witch. Well, we walked within its sheltering range and I did a turn and thanked the directions and the elements, the earth, the water, the fire, and the air that had brought me there. I took deep breaths of the radically high oxygen. And then we went back to the car, to our great big Range Rover, started up the engine, and drove away. Now, the whole rainforest is a national park, and it stands astride the Olympia National Forest. Now, you folks know what a national forest is, right? Those words should strike fear into your heart. You can identify a national forest by its one characteristic feature: the beautiful motherfucking clear cuts. Now, this is not an ecological rant. I'm not Al Gore, but I mean, really. I lost count of all the barren hillsides. Every time we came across another one, I'd say, oh, another beautiful clear cut. The barren hillsides, the denuded hillsides, the fields of debris. And of course, they replant them, absolutely. They replant them with a monoculture of fast-growing trees that can then be harvested 30 years later to make more profits. Now, is this bad? Is this wrong? I can only say that it looks and feels wrong. At the very least, it's extremely unaesthetic. And I grew sick in my soul every time I came across these holes in this otherworldly forest. And the interesting thing is that the pillaging bastards know this, because more often than not, they would leave a thin strip of trees right along the highway, so that if you weren't too observant and didn't look in too deeply, you couldn't see the So, we headed straight for the ferry back to Seattle from the rainforest. And once we'd gone on board the ferry, I immediately clambered out like a little kid to the bow of the boat so we could stand the wind and the spray that's coming from the front of the ferry. And I luxuriated in the bracing cool wind of Puget Sound. And we faced forward into the breeze constantly, almost until the moment we docked. Getting close to the dock, we passed back into the cabin to go down to the car. And all of a sudden, when the cabin door swings shut behind me, the force of the wind, which has been constant and eternal on me since I walked up on deck, stops. And all of a sudden, I have to completely readjust myself because I'm no longer standing against that force. And I also become very suddenly aware that the ship is rocking and that if I'd actually been feeling that for the last 20 minutes, I'd be puking now. But all of those motions, all of those feelings of motion on the sea, that subtlety, they were drowned out by this wonderful wind and that cleansing wind. But once that wind went away, the undertow became painfully present. That's when I had my second epiphany. Now, to be truthful, that epiphany started a little bit earlier in San Francisco. A very close friend of mine, someone that I love and I trust and I respect, told me that quite honestly, she doesn't watch the television and she doesn't read the news and she doesn't do any of the other things that I assume can constellate a really well-informed individual. And this seemed very shocking to me at first, because TV is our dirty little secret. It's our little addiction and guilty pleasure. And we all know it. And I've made an entire career in Australia talking about how I continue to watch United States television by downloading it off of BitTorrent. And okay, there's enough media. And then there's more than enough media, and then there is way more than enough media. And fish aren't aware of the water they swim in, and nor are we in America aware of the incredible level of media saturation in this culture. But when you step outside this culture, say to Australia, the wind ceases, and you need to catch yourself. And you can actually feel the sickening yaw of the craft. Now, last year at Mind States, I encouraged folks to cultivate an ecology of the mass media, that was going to be a very healthy thing to do as a way to deal with the shrieking wind of mass media. And I could talk about it. Ecologies of mass media, or I could tell you to go read the blog because there's a lot on there about that. Or I could simply point to the beautiful motherfucking clear cuts. Is that ecology? Do we think that's ecology? How strong does the wind have to blow before the trees fall over? How powerful does the storm have to be before the houses cave in?
Right.
Part 3, Castles in the Air. And so finally to Seattle, to the end of my journeying, and there are no more epiphanies, that's your warning. We're down to questions here, but first, I got hammered with one of my good friends, James Kent. And James Kent has been obsessed for 15 years with understanding how psychedelics work, ever since he first took them. And he thinks now, finally, that he knows. And let me give you the theory in a nutshell. I think he wants me to actually flat my mouth because he certainly went out and we both got very hammered and he went over his theory in some detail and I remember a lot of it. And so let me just tell you his theory for how psychedelics work. His theory for how psychedelics work is that they simply produce a feedback loop between the perception center in the brain and the cognitive center in the brain. And that's really all there is about to it. And he's developed some formal models for this and some mathematical models for this. And it's interesting because it seems to be a very simple and elegant model. And in general in science, when you get simple and elegant, you tend to get correct. Not always. But the interesting thing about this model is that it's a testable model, and that's a good thing. But the problem being that this is a no-go area for neuroscientists since Timothy Leary shit the bed 45 years ago. And all of neuroscience has developed in the past 45 years. You know, what did we know about neuroscience in 1961? Not a thing. So here's an area where an outsider, because he doesn't have a PhD, with non-specific knowledge inside of a field can come into a field and actually make an enormous difference. And what I've just outlined for you are the basic ideas that T.S. Kuhn explores in the structure of scientific revolutions. This is how paradigm changes happen. You have someone who's not specific in the field who comes in and says, excuse me, emperor has no clothes. And everyone goes, emperor has no clothes. So the interesting thing about this circle of feedback between your perception and cognition is that the more feedback you get, the more you're iterating, essentially. You're taking some sample and passing it through different centers of your brain and passing it back and forth and iterating and iterating and iterating. Well, fractals are iterative mathematical functions. And so I suggested to James the other day that the reason that fractals are so endlessly fascinating to people high on psychedelics is because there's an actual resonance. It's an exteriorization of what's actually going on inside your head. He gave me a high five for that. We'll see. But what this does mean, at least as far as James is concerned, I'll be agnostic on this point for a moment, is that there are no allies in the plants, per se. There's no genetic exchange of knowledge with an alien mushroom entity. There are no self-transforming machine elves. And frankly, that's a good thing, because simplicity is good. Occam's razor demands simplicity. And theory is fine, and his is testable. So I drunkenly advised him, James, you gotta get in touch with V.S. Ramachandran. You know, a real neuroscientist, and someone who's spoken at the Mind States conferences. So that we can test your theory, and we can know for sure, up or down, right or wrong. Because theories by themselves are castles in the air. And then on to a pre-party last night in Seattle. People were costuming up and putting on makeup and black lipstick and that sort of thing. And I'm party to a casual conversation. This young woman is saying, I don't like him. She's talking about a famous writer. He believes in death. I don't believe in death. Now that might sound strange, except of course for the circles that I frequent, and such a statement is reasonably appropriate in those circles. Well, he's a humanist, I quipped, and you're a transhumanist. Yeah, well, humanists suck, she said. Well, consider the alternative, IFM replied. So, it's interesting because we've got another example of a castle in the air. The mind is duking it out with the body. Transhumanists, all about the mind. Humanists, all about the body. The body decays, the body dies. There's tragedy. Transhumanists, it just goes up and up, but never up. And it's interesting because the most important thing, I think, overall that I learned from reading Eric's book, Technosis, is that the mind and the body are kind of like a codependent couple on the Jerry Springer show. No one's in the right. Neither survives without the other, but both want a divorce. And so finally to the party itself. And it was one of those night affairs where everyone knows so much about pharmacology and neurochemistry that it seems more like grad school than a bacchanal. But there they are, they're very pretty young things, they're Paris, they're tattooed, they're gender bent, they're chemically bent, they're bi and poly and queer and all of the above. It's the ocean of the flesh swimming in the sea of the spirit. And those freaks are my people. Those are the ones who matter. And they're thriving, even under the towering stone of the empire. And the creaking wood of the empire. They had managed somehow to establish their liminality, to place it in the shadow directly, deliberately, and temporarily, because theirs too is a castle in the air. And all castles come crashing down. All castles in the air come crashing down to earth. But somehow it doesn't matter, because we are human, and we're transhuman, and we're subhuman, and we're maybe not even human at all. Because everything, at every moment, could come crashing down. And it will in the long run, but it doesn't matter. It didn't matter last night, full of scotch and ketamine, knowing that I've traveled like someone on the Silk Road of old, the entire extent of the empire, which is no longer a trip through lands, but instead a trip through trips, from the center to the ultimate periphery, from the beating heart to the bleeding edge. It's all right here, it's all right now, and you were there, and you were there, and you.